I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up in the program, we will have the first of a series of conversations we're having this week about how young people are using social media. We're calling the series Social Me, and that will be later in the program. But first, we want to focus on the historic announcement by Defense Secretary Leon Panetta last week that the military will end the ban on women in combat. The change potentially opens up more than 200,000 jobs to women, many of them in infantry positions. But these women, should they be selected for these posts, will not be the first women to serve on the front lines. Take, for example, Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth. She is a former Army National Guard helicopter pilot. She lost both of her legs when she served in Iraq, but she still serves as a lieutenant colonel in the Army National Guard. Now she's a Democrat representing Illinois' 8th District, and she's with us now from her home office to talk about what these changes might mean. Congresswoman Duckworth, first of all, let me say congratulations on your election, and of course, thank you for your service.
Thank you, Michelle. It's wonderful to be on.
So what was your reaction when you heard the Pentagon announcement?
My reaction was it's about time that finally Pentagon's policy is catching up with the reality of what's happening on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Why do you think the announcement came when it did?
I think that this is a decision that's been a long time in the making, Michelle. I think that a couple key things happened. One, we've been at war for 10 years where women have been directly engaged in combat, and thousands of women have received the Combat Action Badge, which is only awarded when you engage in direct fire with the enemy. So you have 10 years of that under our belt. We also have had a change in the Pentagon leadership. I think that the top leaders in the Pentagon now are folks who have served since the 70s when women became fully integrated in the Army. For example, the WAC was fully integrated in the mid-1970s. So I think there's a combination of things, and I think it's a president who's been dedicated to equal rights in all ways and equal work and equal pay for women, and I think this is just another step in what this president wants to do in terms of making sure that there's equality in our culture.
Do you mind reminding us of, first of all, why you wanted to serve and why you wanted to serve as a helicopter pilot?
Sure, Michelle. Well, I just wanted to give something back, and I didn't know how I was going to serve my nation. And when I was in graduate school, actually, I became a second lieutenant while pursuing a PhD. So a little bit later in life, I took some ROTC courses, fell in love with the discipline, the leadership opportunities, and decided I would, try for my commission. As far as aviation was concerned, in 1993, was when they lifted the restriction on women serving in combat. And since that was the only combat job available to women, I signed up for it, not because I wanted to go into combat, but for me, it was a sense of fairness. I just felt like if I wanted equal pay for equal work, I should take equal risk as the men to my left and to my right.
You know, to that point, as you might imagine, we, along with, every other media outlet and of course, a lot of any other vehicle for discussion, really, where people are interested in this issue, have been getting a lot of comments since the announcement was made. And many of the women veterans say exactly what you said at the outset of our conversation. You said, it's about time. I mean, it kind of recognizes the reality of warfare now. Anyway, many women like yourself are serving, taking hostile fire and making the sacrifice as you did. But we got some other interesting comments, and I'll just play one of them, actually. This is a woman named Elizabeth Somalio. She is from Ohio. She started in the U.S. Army in March of 1988 and retired last July. She retired at the rank of Sergeant First Class. And I'll just play her comment.
The fact of the matter is it's still a man's army. Some of those men are just not going to allow those women to lead appropriately. And when lives are on the line, that's what concerns me. When you're looking at the toll of war and is it worth the chance and risk? No, I just don't believe it is. And, there's a high sexual assault rate going on in the military. And when you start adding in women in combat arms and the stressors of war, it doesn't make a good mix.
Unlike some people who, people are hearing from who say that women aren't capable of serving in these positions or it's just too distracting for the men, she's making, first of all, a readiness argument that some of these men just will not be able to deal with having women in leadership positions or they just can't accept it and it will be a force readiness issue. And she's also commenting on something which I think people all know to be true, which is that there is a sexual assault issue.
Right. So let's deal with those two arguments separately, mm-hmm. Michelle. First off, Women are fantastic leaders, and the same thing was said of women, going into aviation, for example. And I was a leader in aviation. I was a company commander. And did I get a little bit of a harassing when it first started? And, you know, they called me the mommy company commander. But the bottom line is we were number one in readiness in our battalion. And performance certainly outstrips and out-argue any contradictory, positions. And basically do it based on your job performance. Lots of women are great leaders. And lots of men are great leaders, too. I actually think that the military and our nation will benefit when we have more women at the very highest positions. And women can't get there right now in the military, not as quickly as men, because they can't hold command at the of combat armed units. And you need that command time of combat forces in order to become, for example, commander of the United States forces in Europe. So a woman will never become a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff if she doesn't have a chance to command a combat division like the First Infantry Division. Hmm. So this will lift that restriction. And I think as you see more women in combat situations, you're going to see that they can certainly perform at the very highest level.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Congresswoman and decorated military pilot Tammy Duckworth. We're talking about the Pentagon's decision to lift the ban on women serving in combat. Are the physical standards going to be adjusted for women?
I think the physical standards should be set for the job. Right now, the physical standards are adjusted for two things. One, for gender. So there's different standards for men and women, at least in the Army. Some of the other branches are different. And then they're also adjusted for age. So if you're 30 years old, your physical standards are lower than for someone who's 18 years old. So if you want to have one uniform physical standard, then have it. Don't adjust for age and don't adjust for gender. Make it for the job. If the job requires you have to be able to lift 80 pounds and march 20 miles in a certain amount of time, then set it for the job. And if you can meet those standards, then great. You get to do the job, and it doesn't matter whether you're black, white, male, female, straight, or gay.
And what about the sexual assault question? Without any comment about how widespread or not widespread this sort of problem is, the fact is this has been a persistent problem, which has finally, it seems, gotten the recognition that it deserves. What about that?
Well, military sexual trauma is absolutely an issue. It's not an issue that's tied to this decision, though. It's already existed. I think the military is doing a better job of dealing with it, but I think there's more work that needs to be done. But let's make this clear. Sexual assault, it's not a female problem. Sexual assault is a problem with predators. So we cannot blame with the women who serve this country in uniform for being assaulted. And to say that we can't allow women to serve in a full range of jobs because they may become victims is really disgusting to me, because the problem is in the leadership and the problem is in fixing the predator problem. I trust in the professionalism of our military to do their jobs and do it well. But we have to certainly focus more on making sure that the military does a better job with sexual assault. And that, to me, is a separate issue from women serving in combat. Also, it ignores the fact that half of the sexual assaults that happen are against men. So we don't even know about those statistics publicly. I mean, it's known, but it's not something that the public, when people talk about military sexual trauma, people don't think about, this trauma is happening to male troops. And it is just as much as it is happening to female troops. It's not about sex. It's about power. It's about one person trying to seize control of another person's body. And that simply is not acceptable in any situation.
I did want to just raise it kind of as a concluding point, the criticism or the point raised by your fellow Congressman Duncan Hunter. He's a Republican of California. He's also a veteran of the Marines. And he says his question is whether this change will actually make our military better at operating in combat, specifically finding and targeting the enemy. I don't know that that's the only question about better performance in combat. But on the overall question is, do you think this makes the military better or not? How do you answer?
I think it will make the military better, Michelle. We have an all-volunteer force. That means that 100% of the people who serve in our military want to be there, have volunteered to be there. And when you open up a whole new talent pool of potential people to serve in these positions, you've now opened up you know, a lot more potential for some of the highest achieving people to serve. So whereas before, for all of these jobs, the talent pool that was available from which they could recruit was just 50% of our population. Now we've doubled the potential pool of recruits who could serve in that position. Not every woman will be able to pass the physical standards for some of these jobs. But frankly, some of the other positions, like a tank commander, doesn't take a great amount of physical strength. So a lot of positions will be open up. We'll have an opportunity to recruit from the very best in our nation. And women will have an opportunity to finally get recognition for the service that they're already performing.
5 years from now, what kind of conversation do you think we'll be having about this?
Just how much this was a big hoopla about very little. You know, I think we're already having those conversations about ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's already a matter of a record that we say, of course, blacks and whites can serve together in integrated units without problems, or that Japanese Americans can serve, without problems. That was the thought in World War II, that you couldn't integrate the military. So I think, you know, down the road, we're going to look back at this and say, boy, that was a lot of fuss over nothing.
Tammy Duckworth is a former helicopter pilot with the Army National Guard. She still serves as a lieutenant colonel in the Army National Guard, and she's currently representing Illinois' 8th District in the U.S. Congress. And also want to mention, she's also a former assistant secretary in the Department of Veterans Affairs. A busy person. Tammy Duckworth, thank you once again for your service. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we keep hearing about the trouble kids can get into and cause with their online identities, but new research suggests that there are some advantages, too, and we will talk about that in our new mini-series, Social Me, and we'll start that series in just a few minutes. But first, we want to hear about Zimbabwe, which is heading toward elections in the next few months. Longtime President Robert Mugabe, at 88 years old, has held power there for more than three decades. Critics blame him for the country's economic meltdown and decades of political violence. But Mugabe is eyeing yet another term in office. And despite a much heralded power-sharing agreement with a former opposition leader, activists say the abuses of civil society and human rights activists continues. We wanted to hear more about this, so we caught up with Magadonga Malungu and Jenny Williams from the Zimbabwean grassroots movement Women of Zimbabwe Arise, or WOZA. They were in Washington for a brief visit with other activists, and they are with us now. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us short trip to the United States.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
We know that, you know, Zimbabwe, or Mr. Mugabe, was supposed to have entered into a power-sharing arrangement after the last election. He was supposed to be working with, you know, the opposition groups. They were supposed to have been brought into the government. And yet we hear that the, you know, acts of reprisal against political opponents, the censorship, and all of the same things that we've been hearing all along are still going on. Jenny, could you talk a little bit about the conditions that a group like yours faces in trying to do your work?
Well, you know, being a human rights defender is putting yourself at severe risk of arrests, torture, abduction. And not only as human rights defenders do we face that, but in the normal average daily life of a Zimbabwean, you can get arrested. They are criminalizing defending human rights. They're criminalizing just merely being an informal trader trying to eke a living with over 98% unemployment. And so every day in Zimbabwe, everyone faces this barrage of persecution, and it's hell.
Magadonga, I understand that between the two of you, between you and Jenny, that you've been arrested nearly 100 times. Is that so? On what grounds?
Yes, that's true. We have been arrested over 100 times between the two of us for merely speaking out, for merely saying that you want bread, you want water. My first arrest was said that I sang discordantly, then I was arrested for that.
Did I hear that right? Singing discordantly?
Yes.
You were arrested for singing discordantly?
Yeah, it was
That's a charge?
Yeah, it was a hymn from the Bible, a religious song.
Jenny, do I have it right that Is it that you were once arrested for selling jam? Is that right? Or the two of you were?
Oh, no. She was the one arrested.
She was arrested.
Selling the jam.
You were selling
jam. I was also singing with her, but I wasn't singing discordantly.
Oh, you weren't singing discordantly.
But she got arrested also, so it didn't matter.
You can laugh about it.
We can laugh about it because otherwise we'd cry.
And this is how we survive, by laughing at these things.
The fact that not only were we arrested, but then we were taken into the most horrific conditions and kept in custody for over 48 hours. We were arrested as a preventative measure so that we wouldn't be part of an International Women's Day demonstration, which we then, in the cell, prison cell in Bulawayo, listened to our colleagues go ahead with the demonstration outside and had a little bit of fun, at least singing the songs that we would have been singing if we'd have been out of custody. And the victory was is that our colleagues went ahead with the protest.
Do you mind if I ask, Jenny, forgive me, but what were the conditions there? What have been the conditions there?
Well, I never forget that for me that was the 13th or 14th arrest. For Makotanga it was the very first time. And I'd actually told her that dirt is warm, Makotanga, so be brave if you're going to get arrested. And I remember the cell is actually just like a 3x5. There's the filth, the toilets are overflowing, they stink, they never flush. There are blankets, but if you use the blankets, you must fight with the lice to keep warm. And I remember she stood by the door and I walked in and I just lay down because I'd been used to it now and dirt's warm anyway. And she just looked at me and she said, "Oh no, you're lying there amongst the dirt." And I said, "Okay, well, just carry on sitting at the door if you like." And eventually she crept over and she sat down on the cement and eventually she was covering up with the blanket herself. And you're like that for 48 hours. You're not allowed to change. You're not allowed to dress. We are constantly harassed with insults by prison police officers, plain clothes and uniform. We are called prostitutes just for defending our rights. I'm often insulted because of the color of my skin, even though I'm of mixed race. And we just know that for 48 hours we'll be at the total mercy of these people.
Do you mind if I ask if you feel forgotten by the rest of the world? I mean, it is, I believe, fair to say that, you know, Zimbabwe at times has been very much on the agenda of the international media, but really less so, I think it's fair to say, in recent years. Do you feel forgotten? Makotanga, do you wish to answer that? Do you feel that anyone else is paying attention?
Most of the times we feel that we are not a priority and then we get forgotten. For instance, right now, all the attention now will be on Kenya because Kenya is going ahead with their election before us.
But we're also forgotten because Jenny, we're women. You know, we are majority in Zimbabwe, 52% of the population.
Is that so? 52% of the population
is female? Absolutely.
And,
you know, we also probably even more than that because most men find it easier to escape to other countries and travel abroad. They have more opportunities. We're forgotten because we're women. We're forgotten in society because we're perceived to be second-class citizens who shouldn't have a voice.
And Woza, tell me about this group, Women of Zimbabwe Arise. You held your first protest on Valentine's Day in 2003. Tell me about how this organization came about. And Woza has a meaning in Ndebele, right?
Yeah, it means come forward. And we use it because we feel that, woman, it's time for you to come forward, take your place, and do the work that you should do to show Zimbabweans a non-violent method of holding your government accountable, a way that we can have a combined collective voice and bring the discourse away from politics and political power and onto the issues that are important to everyday Zimbabweans. Do we have water? Do we have electricity? Can we get our children educated as a promise of the Liberation War for free primary education? And can we feel that we have a voice around bringing our new constitution? And we march in the streets of Zimbabwe peacefully, singing our songs and holding our placards and demanding that right to protest, that right to occupy our streets. It's just incredible.
How are people earning a living? How are people just living day to day?
by the grace of God, by the ability to maybe buy some tomatoes in the market, and if you are brave enough, you'll manage to sell those and eke a little bit of living. We no longer talk of having three meals a day. It's if you can afford it, how do you have one meal a day to just keep that hunger at bay? And don't forget that we have a massive pandemic. The HIV/AIDS pandemic is taking people. I've lost so many of my comrades in Warsaw over these years. It's just a recipe for disaster in Zimbabwe.
What keeps you going?
Well, what keeps me going and what keeps us all as women going is that for once in our lives in the history of Zimbabwe, we managed to create a platform where we speak with one voice, looking at the needs of a woman and ordinary person without looking at which political party we come from. It's in our hands. We feel that we've empowered ourselves to speak with one voice as women of the nation.
Well, Jenny, what about you?
Well, you know, there's an addictive thing about freedom. When we organize our protests and we defy all the unjust laws that are in place, and we're in the street holding our placards and marching, we feel like complete whole citizens. And that freedom that we make and demand is so contagious, and that makes us feel whole. It makes us feel relevant. Our children see us marching and they realize that freedom is what you demand, what you make of it. And what also is exciting for us is to attend the inauguration of President Barack Obama and see that a community organizer is being inaugurated as the 44th president of the United States of America. Hey, wow, that's just incredible. And someone who comes from a marginalized space in society of mixed race, those are the opportunities that we think shouldn't only belong to Americans, they should belong to Zimbabweans.
Jenny Williams and Magadonga Malungu are with the activist movement WOZA, or Women of Zimbabwe Arise. We were able to catch up with them on a very brief trip to Washington, D.C., so we are thankful that we had the opportunity to visit with them while they were here. Jenny Williams and Magadonga Malungu with WOZA, or Women of Zimbabwe Arise, they were here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Washington. For having us.
Now we want to turn to a topic we've touched on before in various ways. Today we begin a three-part series looking at how young people are interacting online. And let's just admit it, often when this subject comes up, it's in a negative way, focusing on online bullying or hacking or even the new phrase many of us just learned, catfishing, where someone lures someone into an online relationship under false pretenses. But there's more to it than that. So we've decided to take a step back, and over the next 3 days, we are going to be focusing on social media and kids. It's a short series we are calling Social Me. We are going to look at the kinds of apps young people are buying and using, how they're developing online identities, and how they're using social media for their own education. We are going to start today with a look at online identities. Our guide for this series is Ray Junco. He is a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Ray, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks, Michelle. It's great to be here.
As I mentioned, we often hear about the negatives of online anonymity, but I understand your research actually points to some positives. So why don't we start there?
Sure. When you hear about it in the media, you often hear about the online disinhibition effect, although most people don't call it that, which basically means that people perceive this level of anonymity because they're behind a computer screen. And it's often associated with cyberbullying. However, my research has shown that online disinhibition can be a positive factor for online interactions. So, for example, it allows introverted students to make interpersonal connections that they might not have made because of, you know, their shyness or the ways they interact in the offline world. And those online interactions translate to offline interactions.
Could you give an example of that? Because I think a lot of people have had the experience of maybe having some difficulty communicating with, say, a teenager in their house. Mm-hmm. And then when the student goes off to college, for example, and they find themselves emailing each other, mm-hmm. things get easier, you know, mm-hmm. somehow, because you don't have all mm-hmm. that face-to-face mm-hmm. tension, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So can mm-hmm. you think of an example of just from your own experience teaching where the kind of online interaction just made things easier for a student?
One example was when I first started teaching, and way, way back in the day when people used AOL Instant Messenger a lot, I would put my AOL IM screen name on my syllabi. And I would let students know if they had any questions about the class that they could feel free and pop in to AOL IM and ask me questions. And there was this one student who was very shy, very reserved, very introverted in class. And then he would message me from time to time and just, you know, like a little message here or there, like basic questions about the course, not really anything about, you know, any kind of interpersonal interaction or anything like that. And what I saw is that over time, this same student then was able to bring questions into the class. And that was one of the early instances of me seeing that. And then over time, not only did I see more examples of individual students, but I've conducted research where we've seen this at the group level. So students who we interact with online, for instance, on Twitter, are much more engaged in the classroom, and they're building more of a community in the classroom than students who aren't engaging that way through social media. And it's very clear, and we have data to show, that those online interactions lead to more positive classroom interactions.
Why is it, though, that so much of what we hear about the disinhibition, as you put it, of the online identity is so negative and hurtful? I mean, we hear about, you know, forgive me, parents, I'll just say it, slut shaming. We hear about, you know, people using their online identities to pick on kids, mm-hmm. around all kinds of things, especially bullying, you know, posting, you know, just really hurtful things about each other online. Why is that so much what we hear about? And why do they do it at all? Why do they do that at all?
I think the first part is we hear a lot more about that because, well, it's newsworthy. It's what people want to hear. It gets hits to websites. It gets viewership to news programs. It sells magazines if people are still buying magazines.
Okay, but to be fair, Ray, the fact is kids have taken their own lives because of what they've experienced,
sure.
in this realm. So there, you know,
sure.
there have been really harmful consequences to kids, what they've experienced online. So I don't think that's not made up. But
absolutely. I'm not trying to minimize that one bit. The other part of my answer is that kids can be mean. The teenage years are a very difficult time developmentally. Teens are struggling with acceptance of themselves and often shaming and bullying others as a way to compare themselves to another and feel, quote unquote, better than. It can often sometimes be a way to fit in with their peers as well, if that's a socially acceptable behavior in their peer group. Teens don't have as strongly developed superegos as most adults, at least we hope most adults, and they also reflect what they see in society.
I think a lot of parents, a lot of caregivers, a lot of teachers are really concerned that the things that kids are posting online will haunt them later on in their adult lives. I mean, do you think that that's true?
Absolutely. That's exactly where we are right now in our society, because people who are making evaluations of youth for jobs and for admissions to colleges and for admissions to grad school didn't grow up in such a digitally enabled social milieu. So I think it's very important for us to talk with our children about what they're posting online and for them to be aware of that. But I think it's also very important that as a society, we think about how we want to treat those instances of things that youth may post because they don't know any better or because it's a mistake. I mean, think about all the mistakes you made and that you chalk up to developmental mistakes, right? And you think back and you're like, wow, that was really embarrassing. And hopefully you learned something from that. But imagine if that same mistake was out there for anybody to see if they Googled your name. And so if you have a name like Bob Smith, you're probably okay. But if you have a name like Ray Junco, then that's going to pop up and that's going to stay with you forever.
Ray Junco is a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He joined us from WPSU at Penn State University. Ray Junco, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Michelle, anytime.
Please join us tomorrow when Ray will be talking about a way to use the internet to enhance your children's education. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You know how they say never judge a book by its cover? Well, now we hear from someone you probably think you know. You've certainly seen him just about every day for the last 15 years or so, NBC Today Show weatherman Al Roker. But while you may have witnessed his fluctuating weight, he once topped the scales at 340 pounds. Today he's a fit 200. Behind the numbers and the jovial, fun, fat guy veneer was an intense struggle, one that included numerous failed diets, pleas from his wife, and a promise his father demanded from his deathbed. Al Roker details those moments in a remarkably candid new book. It's called Never Going Back, Winning the Weight Loss Battle for Good, and he is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Michelle. How are you?
Well, I'm good, but, you know, there are a lot of good things to being in the public eye. I think we can both agree
sure,
with that.
Absolutely.
But there's a downside, and one of the downsides is that people can see the struggle with your weight. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to lay it all out and in some really excruciating, in some parts, detail, and why now?
Well, it seems for some reason in the last few years, people are really curious about my weight loss and what I've done to keep it off. Whenever I, are at a public appearance or anything like that, that's usually one of the first questions. Right before, what time do you get up every morning? So, yeah, I thought, so many people struggle with their weight. You know, I don't want anybody to think, okay, I read this book and I'm going to lose 100 pounds. That's not the case. It's really more of a memoir seen through the prism of weight loss and somebody who's struggled with weight all their life.
Hmm. That is one of the questions I had that you answered in the book, which is that you say that you battled with weight your entire life, but you also say in the book that it really kind of hit you at age 15 when Bill Cosby developed a Fat Albert character, and I'm not going to take you through that again. I'm not going to spare you hearing.
No, no, but it, you know,
but
it, well,
just describe just the terribleness of it. Why was it so bad?
I'm black, I'm fat, my name's Albert. It was the embodiment of who I had become. I'm at 15 years old. I'm a sophomore in high school, and here's this character. And it started as a special it was a Thursday night on NBC, and I remember thinking maybe somehow nobody I know saw this, and I get to school, and walk into the cafeteria. And it's a chorus of, hey, 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 and it's like, oh, okay. But, you know, you're in high school, so you've got to kind of, put on a false front and, hey, yeah, isn't that funny? Mm. Oh, God. It was even then that you're kind of confronted with it, but you use humor or whatever, the jolly fat person to kind of deflect.
What if you could just describe it for people who never lived through it, never struggled with their weight, what do you think is like the worst thing about it?
I don't know if it's any one worst thing. It's a series of little indignities. Getting on a plane and worrying that the seatbelt isn't going to fit, or that if it doesn't fit and you kind of discreetly whisper to the flight attendant that you need an extender, and they go rummaging around for it, and then they, get on the intercom and ask the flight attendant in the back to bring up an extender, and then she hands it to that flight attendant. Well, everybody pretty much knows what's going on. I've got kids from my oldest, who's now 25, but, the heartbreak of not being able to get on a ride with her because the restraining bar won't close on the roller coaster, whatever ride it is you're going on. That it's those little things that you're like, ugh. or the terror of realizing you left, say, some clothing home on a trip. Now you have to try and find a pair of pants, let's say, which you can't go to the Gap or any place like that. I mean, now, ironically, today, you can go to Old Navy and they're carrying pants up to size 50, which I think is more of a commentary on or the reality of America's new weight gain.
You know, when you have a whole chapter in the book titled The Indignities of Being Fat, and people would actually watch what you eat and ask, are you supposed to eat that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, they feel quite emboldened and quite free about pointing out things to you, where they just feel the freedom. And I also feel that, fat is the last bastion of political incorrectness. If you want to get a cheap laugh in a sitcom or a movie, put a fat person in and have them do something or have something happen to them. And it's, oh, look at the fat person struggle. Oh, isn't that great?
But you say, though, in the book, you say, said you wanted to, like what people would say, are you supposed to be eating that? And you'd say you'd want to reply, are you supposed to be rude?
Exactly.
Why didn't you?
You know what? Because when your whole persona is that of somebody, who's fun and funny and, people, then it's, that Al Roker, oh my gosh, what a jerk. Although now I will admit I do feel a little more emboldened. About a couple of weeks ago, a guy comes up and I get this all the time now, which I don't think people realize what they're saying. I thought you were funnier when you were fatter. I said, yeah, and I thought you were smarter before you opened your mouth.
Okay.
But people say the darndest things, as Art Linkletter once said.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Al Roker. That is a name and a face that you surely know, weatherman for the Today Show. He chronicles his more than 100-pound weight loss in a new book. It's called Never Going Back, Winning the Weight Loss Battle for Good. You write about how you had bariatric surgery, which basically reduced your stomach to the size of an egg. And I just want to make it clear, as you make it clear in the book, that you're not recommending this.
Right.
You are, just like you don't recommend diets or weight loss programs, because as you point out, this is a very personal and individual thing. But I do want to ask why you were so secretive about it. I mean, you say that you didn't tell even your coworkers about it until a few months after the procedure. And then only because one of the tabloids was about to reveal this. What was that about?
Well, it was about a lifelong struggle with my weight and trying different diets and failing. And in my mind, I felt pretty confident that I was going to lose this weight. But, I mean, this is after this, there's no other options. I mean, when you do bariatric surgery, you're pretty much, you've run the gamut. And my fear was that it was going to come back, or it wouldn't take, or something would happen, and I would just, besides being fat again, then I would look really stupid and just be an abject failure. And so I thought, if I don't tell anybody, then maybe nobody will notice, and I'll just lose the weight, and then I can kind of reveal that I've lost this weight. That was the only flaw in my whole plan, that I hadn't thought about the fact that actually, I am going to lose a lot of weight, and it's going to be pretty rapid. And in being on TV, a few people might notice. So it just was a poorly thought out plan.
Did you feel that, in a way, it would seem like a failure, like the easy way out, and that people would judge you for it?
I get people asking that all the time, or saying that, well, you lost weight, but it was a cheat. You took the, and I'm thinking, let's see, somebody goes in, makes holes where there aren't, rearranges your insides. You now have to take massive multivitamins and supplements because your body can't absorb or doesn't get what it needs from the food. There's a 1 in 200 chance of dying from either the surgery or complications therein. There can be chronic complications from this, and I refuse to ever endorse this. I mean, I've turned down 6-figure checks from organizations to represent them, and I won't do it because forget about all this other stuff. The last thing I want is somebody to come up to me and say to me, you know what, my mother or my father, my brother, sister, wife, husband had the gastric bypass because you recommended it and they died. I just don't want that on my conscience. I can't deal with that. So, I won't recommend it. And look, any good surgeon, and there are a lot of them have popped up to do this. Do you know there's no board certification for bariatric surgery? If you're a surgeon and you can get a hospital to give you space, a lot of them now don't even do it in a hospital. They do it in suite, although they need to have it really done in a hospital. But you can be a bariatric surgeon.
This is the other thing I think was kind of surprising to me to read it in the book, is the hateration when you do lose the weight. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you talk about the indignities, the large and small indignities of having excess weight. But then when you do lose the weight, the hateration of people who really don't seem to be happy for you.
Well, here's the deal. I talk with saboteurs who either, unconsciously or consciously don't like what you've done. Part of the problem, I had low self-esteem. My self-esteem was because of the weight, or not just because of the weight, but that was one of the symptoms of it. And, you know, so you have a different persona in a sense. Once you lose the weight, you know, there's a certain self-confidence, a certain self-esteem. You feel better. And people may not be able to deal with that person. They were used to the other person, the person who, you know, was kind of ashamed of themselves and wasn't happy with themselves, you know, and all of a sudden here you're a different person, or if not different, you're certainly there are parts of you that are more positive, more self-assured, more self-confident. Mm. And people, I think, have problems dealing with that. Or all of a sudden, they're not the best looking person in the room.
You're right. So you have some very interesting reflections on weight and how it kind of affects you and affects how you are perceived. And for example, you write, "Was I heavy because I was shy, or was I painfully shy and became heavy as a way to help insulate myself? My weight gave me a barrier that somehow made me feel safe because I desperately feared rejection. I played the 'it's not my fault I'm fat' card a lot as a way of justifying any type of failure." And you said, "I don't think my weight held me back professionally, but I can't help but wonder if I did this well being fat, how much better could I have done if I'd been fit?" But you also, I think this is to your credit, talk about the fact that thank God you're not a woman, because there's a terrible double standard in our industry that would never have allowed a 340-pound woman to do the news.
Absolutely not. And
was it hard? Was it hard to write that?
No, because I've always felt it. I really have. I mean, you look around on the dial, and it's rare to see a very heavy woman on TV. There was that anchor woman recently who, I think she was in Michigan. I can't remember exactly where. But, you know, some viewer wrote, a really disparaging letter to her or email.
Yeah, but you're not a good role model. That's what she said.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And she answered back on the air. I think that, and look, I have nothing to kick about. I have a terrific job. I have a beautiful wife, 3 great kids. So people have said, "Well, what more do you want? What more could you have achieved?" And the answer is, I don't know. Would I have been president of the United States? No. But I don't know what I would have done.
Well, speaking of the president of the United States, recently you were in Washington for the inauguration.
Yes.
And a couple of your moments have been repeated since as one of the highlights of the day. This is you when you're trying to get Vice President Joe Biden to come over and say hello. Here's you trying to make that happen.
"Mr. Vice President! Mr. Vice President! Mr. Vice President! Mr. Oh. Vice President! Hey, how you doing? Come on, come say, come on!
Whoa.
They won't let you!
Wow. Yes! I got a handshake from Vice President Joe Biden. That's not so bad.
Yeah, you got a handshake from Vice President Joe Biden. You got a thumbs up from the president.
Yes.
Why are we so happy about this? I mean, what is...
You know what? I think because... I don't live in Washington. You know what? We forget, I think, in this country, it's the president of the United States. And guess what? It could have been Barack Obama. It could have been George Bush. I wouldn't have cared. It's the president of the United States who's saying hello to you, who's responding to you. And here's the vice president. He was just, you could see the joy, him walking. He was walking backwards, waving to the crowd.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, you love this guy. I think people responded to the sheer joy of it. And look, I'm a kid from Queens. The president of the United States acknowledged me. The vice president came over and shook my hand. And it was on Martin Luther King Jr.'s day. You know, it was all I could do is to stop from crying, thinking about my parents, about what they would have thought about that. Hmm. I think it means a lot.
Hmm. Well, thank you for thinking that through with me.
Sure. I don't have to go to my therapist. That works out well.
Exactly. How do you feel now that you put all this out there? How do you feel now that you put it all out there?
You know, I feel pretty good about it. I, know, I've been going to these book signings, and it's really humbling to you know, have people come up, and they feel this connection. They feel like, okay, finally somebody gets it. Somebody understands. Because, look, unless you suffer from a weight issue, I'm married to somebody. My wife, Deborah Roberts, I mean, she's, you know, she's been a size 4 for most of her adult life. She runs. She's healthy. It was an issue in our marriage. You know, she could not understand why I could not just push away from the table, shut my mouth, and get up and run or exercise. And that's it's you. I mean, you can't blame anybody else. There's nobody else to blame. It's you. And once you've decided to do this, and it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now that I'm where I am, you know what? I like the way I look, and I like being able to go buy clothes, and I like the idea that I can go into the Gap or Target just to annoy my 14-year-old. I bought shorts, cargo shorts, at Abercrombie & Fitch. Even though she said, you are not buying those. I said, oh, yes, I am. And guess what? I'm wearing them out of the store. So what are you going to do?
Another good reason to lose weight. Annoy your teenagers.
Give back to them what they give to you.
Al Roker is the weatherman and feature anchor for NBC's Today Show. His latest book is called Never Going Back, Winning the Weight Loss Battle for Good. And he was kind enough to stop by our studios in New York City. Al Roker, thank you so much for joining
Michelle,
us.
Thank you, too.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.